I'm Bill Radke, KUOW's The Record. Talking of immigration, again, we are likely getting another executive order on immigration today, and this one focuses on the H-1B visa program. The H-1B visa allows for the temporary hiring of specialized foreign workers, and Trump claims his executive order will lead to more Americans being prioritized for these jobs. The Puget Sound Business Journal's Emily Parkhurst says, yes, our big tech companies like Microsoft and Amazon will feel the squeeze if the order restricts the H-1B visa program. But those companies are not the only ones.
One of his big concerns is really about the Indian staffing companies that use the H-1B visa program to place consultants in a lot of tech companies around the country. And they are by far the largest users of this program in the U.S. and here in the Seattle area.
President Trump has argued that H-1B visas are taking jobs from Americans. How true is that?
You know, I think it's an interesting argument. Basically, if you look at the unemployment rate for folks like software engineers, particularly when you get specialized within those sectors, the artificial intelligence software engineers, it's basically zero. There aren't enough U.S. tech workers to fill some of these jobs, and I think that the tech companies are not lying when they say that they have trouble filling some of these jobs. But on the flip side of that, you know, as I mentioned, there are these basically these foreign companies that bring in tens of thousands of H-1B visa holders into the country for these temporary staffing jobs. And these are jobs that usually last about 3 months, and then these folks move on to a new position, a lot of times within the same company. But they're moving around. They're not permanent positions. And I think in some cases, I think the president is going to find that in some cases, those could have been lower-level U.S. citizens who are trained for these kind of lower-level positions.
So maybe those Indian firms that you cite as an example, maybe those are cases of taking American jobs?
It's a complicated issue, basically, is what the president's going to find when he gets into this. There's a lot of different reasons that people come here on H-1B visas, and in some cases, they're folks who are already here. Who are taking these visas. A lot of them are recent college graduates. They came here to the U.S. To get trained in a lot of these kinds of programs, and in order to work here, they have to get one of these visas after, you know, they have spent time at the University of Washington learning how to be programmers. If they want to work in the U.S., they got to get an H-1B visa. And I think that that's very different than somebody who's coming here to work for a couple of years on a temporary visa and then go back to India. You know, the motivations are different there, and the value for our economy is different there. And when we're thinking about, you know, getting the most from a program like this, the folks who are going to be invested in our community, the folks who are coming here on an H-1B visa with the intent to stay, with the goal of becoming U.S. citizens or at the very least getting permanent residency, they're buying houses. They're contributing to the economy. They're a big part of what has made the Puget Sound economy so successful. And we rely on them for growth here, and the tech companies rely on these folks to continue to innovate and to grow.
Well, Emily, you say that the Amazons and Microsofts claim that there just aren't enough American workers for these jobs. But having foreign workers is also an advantage, right? I mean, critics say these foreign workers are, in effect, indentured servants because the employer holds all the cards.
Yeah, they do hold a lot of the cards. And I think for some of these tech companies, it's a benefit. It's definitely a benefit. You bring somebody over here on an H-1B visa, they're not allowed to really do much other than just work for you. They can't start their own company. It's very, very difficult to transfer to a different company. It's possible, but it's difficult, and you have to really want it. You can't get promoted. You know, your title can't change. So they've got them, and they've got them for as many as 6 years.
And it's typically the company that's sponsoring the worker for permanent residency.
It has to be the company that's sponsoring the worker. Yeah.
So
yeah,
that immobility, that advantage, isn't that a big value to employers? Doesn't that mean that they can pay that foreign worker less money?
Well, you would think so, except that is illegal. One of the things that a company has to do in order to be able to hire an H-1B visa holder is they have to prove to the U.S. government A, that they weren't able to find a U.S. citizen to take that job, and that B, they're going to pay the same amount that they would in salary to a U.S. citizen. They cannot pay less, and if they're found to pay less, they're penalized, and they can lose their right to use the H-1B visa program entirely.
But how enforced is that in reality?
That's a good question. You know, I think companies like Microsoft and Amazon, who know that there's a spotlight on them for this, they're going to be pretty careful about that. I would suspect that they're not going to mess around with that. I think where you see potentials for fraud and for workers being taken advantage of is in some of these consulting companies, frankly, because they're moving their people around a lot, and so it's harder to keep track of who's doing what where. And the federal government doesn't have the manpower to keep track of all of that. It's incredibly challenging, and we're talking about tens of thousands of people. Visas get renewed, so you know there is that cap every year of 85,000 H-1B visas. But if you're also talking about renewals, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people every year who could potentially be moving from job to job if they're consultants. They're difficult to keep track of, and I think that as a result, some of these folks can be taken advantage of. If they lose their job, you technically become an illegal immigrant at midnight, the night that you lost your job.
Bottom line, Emily, do you think anything President Trump does is going to mean higher wages and benefits for both foreign and American workers in Seattle and more jobs for Americans?
You know, I'd hate to weigh in on that right now because we really have no idea what he's going to propose. I suspect it's going to be a hit to Microsoft and Amazon regardless, because these temporary workers, who even if he targets these Indian companies, these Indian staffing companies, a lot of those folks are working for Microsoft and Amazon. So I think it's going to be a hit for our local companies in terms of getting the talent that they need to do the jobs that they need done. And I think that's going to be a hit if there's any reduction.
So we're all waiting for information to learn more, Emily. What is your biggest question about this Trump executive order and how it might actually play out and affect people and employers here in the Puget Sound area?
I think my biggest question for Trump is to see if he's able to unravel the various ways that people use this program and target some of the potential areas for fraud and really tamp down on that. I think that there is a need for that, and I remain hopeful that he will be able to separate that out from the companies who are using this program legitimately and doing so to the benefit of the Puget Sound region's economy.
That's Emily Parkhurst. She's editor-in-chief of the Puget Sound Business Journal, talking about the news today, which is that President Trump's about to sign this executive order that seeks to change the visa program that brings in high-skilled workers. Officials in the government have said that this order is going to ask federal departments to offer changes so that H-1B visas go to the most skilled or highest paid applicants. Officials say the order also seeks to strengthen requirements that American-made products are used in certain federal construction projects. Trump is in Kenosha, Wisconsin today to sign this order, which he calls Buy American and Hire American. Let's go from today's Microsoft to yesterday's Microsoft. In just a moment, the former CEO of that company has used today, Tax Day, to launch a new nonprofit designed to tell you how the government is spending and stewarding your money. That's coming up in just a moment on The Record. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There are no such thing anymore as facts. That's what a Trump advisor famously said a few months ago. So then why is Microsoft's former CEO launching a new project today that's all about facts? Steve Ballmer has just announced his new nonprofit venture designed to show you how America is actually being run, and it's called USA Facts. Here to tell you more is Todd Bishop, co-founder of Seattle's tech news site GeekWire. Hi, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
It's good. Why would Steve Ballmer want us to have facts?
He kind of fell into this one. His wife and he were talking about their own philanthropies, and he challenged her and said, hey, you know, our contributions won't make as much of a difference as if we just pay our taxes.
Uh-huh.
And she said, no, that's not true. And so he started to look into it, and he started to look for something like what's known as a 10K report on the government. And this is
an annual report to investors.
Right. This is very well known among investors. It's made to the SEC. And he was looking for something like that about the government, and he couldn't find one. So he decided to create one. And that's what he's been doing now with a team of more than 30 people. And they just launched this today.
But we have, this is all, he's relying on government information, right? It's already out there.
It is already out there, but it's in all sorts of different places. There is something good that the Treasury Department does in terms of a report like this, but it's not looked at through the lens of a business mind. Hey, we are all paying into this system. You know, the government takes the money, spends it. What are the outcomes? What happens? And that really is what this project USA Facts is about.
Okay, we'll get into what our outcomes are. Tell me about his lens. What's he looking at the government picture? What lens is he using?
He is using the U.S. Constitution as the mission statement. So, for example, they say that the various missions include establishing justice and ensuring domestic tranquility, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, and, of course, securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
And that's our company's mission statement.
That's the mission statement. It's kind of fun for people who are in the business world and interested in government to look at it this way.
Huh.
And so they group all of the different functions of government into those four missions, and then they evaluate them. And he's trying to do this in a fact-based way.
Uh-huh. He's not being partisan.
That's right. He says people should take the facts, inform the conversation, and then come to their own conclusions. But if they start with the facts and everyone is looking at the same set of facts, he believes that the outcomes will actually be better, that we'll be closer than we actually think we are.
And does he have any examples yet of what conclusion the facts have led him to?
A variety of things. First off, it proved that his wife was right, Connie Ballmer.
That's a fact.
Because Steve Ballmer and Connie Ballmer focus in part in their philanthropy on helping inner city youth and making sure that the underserved are helped with funding and finances to essentially realize the American dream. And there are statistics in here that show that that's not happening right now through government funding. He also found that things like crime and emissions, traffic fatalities, the lifespan of the average American, and infrastructure are actually improving. So those are some of the facts that he drew. The deficit is a concern for him, and that is something that he stopped short, though, of offering a remedy. He said, this is a problem. These facts show that it's a problem, but we need to figure it out as a society, and Steve Ballmer is not the person in this context to come up with a solution.
That is a political opinionated judgment, though, right? People disagree. Economists disagree on how important deficits are.
That's true. The simple fact that he would point to is that the deficit is, you know, increasing,
yes,
and that's an issue.
And here's what it's costing.
That's right.
So and you spoke to Steve Ballmer personally
about
this. I wondered, is when you call something USA Facts, we've been talking so much about, you know, there's no such thing as facts,
right,
and fake news and all. So is Ballmer in any way, do you think, reacting to the Trump administration's alleged war on facts?
This project of his started prior to Donald Trump winning the presidency. So I think it's a happy coincidence for him that it happens to counter this trend and play into this whole philosophy. But he did, in fact, say that we're not in a post-fact world.
People talk about alternate facts, they talk about fake news, and yet at the end of the day, the facts will be, particularly the numbers, they are what they are. They tell us about the past. They give us an ability to ourselves judge the forecast that we all have for the future. And there are a lot of reasons why people believe what they believe about issues of government and politics. But at least you have to ground those proposals in a real understanding of what has happened and what the numerical outcomes have been in the past.
Okay, so again, this is Steve Ballmer. We're talking about a new nonprofit launch today devoted to the facts, and the numbers are going to tell us a lot. What is an example of how he sees this report actually being used in accomplishing something?
A couple different ways. First off, he would like this to be a platform that others can use to create applications on top of. So we're talking in very technology terms here. In other words, there's data underlying this. It's built in Microsoft Azure with SQL Server as the database for all the geeks out there. Mm. And he wants other people to come on eventually and build their own apps that that interpret the data and show different aspects of it.
To what end? What's an example of what this is going to accomplish?
One of his hopes is that the government will ultimately do this itself, and that legislators will sign off on this annual report in much the same way that top company executives have to sign off on the 10K report to the SEC. Not saying that it's good or bad, but just saying that it's true. And that is one of his goals.
I noticed that you asked Steve Ballmer kind of what motivated him to do this. He sort of said, like, you know, this is who I am.
Number one, I'm a numbers guy. I really like numbers. That was a part of my je ne sais quoi, if you will, at Microsoft. And I think the appropriate role of numbers is help to take complicated situations and simplify them for people to understand.
Numbers is his je ne sais quoi.
I think he might not know what that means.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's what je ne sais quoi means. But here's what I sort of a challenge, I guess, to Steve Ballmer is, what was so great about his love of numbers? Like, if he was the numbers genius guy at Microsoft, I mean, I'm sure he did a lot of wonderful things, but my impression is that he's best known, rightly or wrongly, for buying Nokia, which was a big mistake, and Microsoft stock just being stagnant.
Yeah, don't forget about Aquantive, which was another giant $6 billion write-off. So that is a very good point. I would say this. First off, he is a numbers guy, and he brags about beating Bill Gates in a math competition at Harvard. So there's no disputing that he knows the numbers, and he was legendary for finding some random fact on page 39 of the PowerPoint that the product managers would present to him and drilling him on it.
Okay.
There is a difference between understanding the facts and then translating that into successful business activity. Now, Steve Ballmer would point to you and talk about Microsoft's market value over the years and all of the cash that it spun off for shareholders. Ballmer would present you with a set of facts to make the case for his tenure as Microsoft CEO. That said, I think
he has alternative facts.
Perhaps he has a different set of facts that he'd want you to look at. I think that there's a difference between understanding the facts and then making that successful in a business. So that would be the answer on that one.
Todd Bishop, co-founder of Seattle's tech news site GeekWire, sat down privately with Steve Ballmer and talked through this new nonprofit venture that Ballmer launched today on tax day. Appropriately enough, today happens to be a federal tax day, with the 15th falling over the weekend. So this was the day to launch something called USA Facts. Todd, thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record. More to come here. We're going to talk about why Seattle is so coy about spending public money on sports stadiums.
Je ne sais quoi.
We have a certain je ne sais quoi when it comes to spending money. Compunctions that other big cities don't seem to have. And we'll talk about why Seattle and the Pacific Northwest geologically rocks and more. So stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Key Arena, Soto Arena, Zero Arena, whatever happens in Seattle, the city is promising that public financing will be minimal. Minimal. If you've lived in other big American cities, you know that is unusual. Cities do not play coy. They throw money at sports teams. Public financing of a palatial stadium? Absolutely. Anything to be in the game. Nevada just put up $750 million in public money for a new NFL stadium. So what is different about Seattle? Sports economist Andrew Zimbalist, professor at Smith College, has an idea.
Yeah, I think that what stands out, of course, is that you lost the Supersonics, and the reason you lost the Supersonics was because the city stood up to the NBA and said that they didn't want to finance a new arena. The NBA has always been interested, in my view, in having a team in Seattle, but they're not willing to sacrifice the principle that the public shouldn't be involved in providing, or at least helping to provide, new arenas for its teams.
Yeah, that principle's been a big moneymaker for them.
Absolutely, yeah. And if it would have given in on the Supersonics, then it would have created a new model that they didn't want to live with.
So what has changed today? Why does Seattle feel so confident about minimizing public financing and still feeling like, yeah, well, the NBA will come back?
I'm not persuaded that Seattle is minimizing anything right now, because the proposals that are out there say that they're looking for public financing, but that they're not specifying how much. Or one of the proposals, I guess, says there's no public financing, but then they're going to be looking for subsidies and tax exemptions and so on. And in any event, the economic impact is always going to be that the devil is in the details. And to just throw out vague terms or vague promises that we're going to minimize something doesn't really mean anything.
Right. So are you saying, in effect, Seattle in 2017 really isn't materially different from other cities when it comes to going after these teams and the Seattle Supersonics? Is that not the story we're telling ourselves?
No, I don't want to say that because I don't know your politicians and I haven't interviewed everybody in Seattle. I'm just saying that when you make public policy decisions about getting in bed with the NBA or the NHL, that you've got to look at the details and that it's often a lot trickier than you think. And I think that Seattle, generally speaking, as a broad proposition, Seattle is different than other cities. Seattle is more secure in who it is or what it is as a city than Las Vegas is. And in consequence, I think that they will do a better job of negotiating a contract. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to be large amounts of public subsidies. It might mean that they'll be smaller than they would be in Las Vegas or Oklahoma City, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be zero.
Right. Nevada just put up $750 million in public money for a new NFL stadium.
Yes.
Why do you think Seattle is, what did you say, more secure?
Yeah, in who it is or what it is as a city. I think that that's right. I think that they know that they have a lot of other things going for it and that it has been and will continue to be a great city, whether or not they have an NBA team. Whereas a city like Las Vegas has an image of itself as a city where people go to gamble, and that's all it is. And going back to the days of Mayor Goodman, they have wanted to say, hey, we're more than that. We're going to show the world that we can also have professional sports teams here. But I don't think that Seattle has the same degree of insecurity about, we can't be a good city unless we have the NBA. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't be nice for Seattle to have the NBA, but I think Seattle, in its psyche, can live quite well without it.
So, Professor, from what you know about the deal Seattle is pursuing with less, significantly less public financing than someplace like Las Vegas, are the deals on the table for Seattle, are they good deals for the taxpaying public?
I can't say. I guess I don't have the details, and I don't think that the details have been made public yet. Look, I think that in terms of the economic effect of having an NBA team or an NHL team in Seattle or both, it's not going to be very significant. And if you end up putting a lot of public money into it, then the net economic effect could very well be negative. If there's enough private money being invested in collateral projects, which is what happens very often these days, I don't think it's the plan in Seattle, but then it's possible that it could even be a positive net impact. But you have to know all of these details before you can start making that kind of an assessment. I think what is true, if we can assume for the moment that the economic impact is neutral or possibly negative, what is true is that you're buying something of social and cultural value. And hence the final determination about how much public money should be put into it is not too dissimilar from deciding how much public money should be put into building a public park. How much is it worth in terms of the social and cultural benefit to have an NBA team in Seattle? That's the basis upon which the investment might make sense. Not that you're going to create economic development.
We're talking with Smith College sports economist Andrew Zimbalist. Two more questions, Professor. One of the investor builder groups says they can pull this off with no pro basketball or hockey team at first because they're going to have Pearl Jam, basically be the house band at Key Arena. They'll play a bunch of concerts there. Now, I know you're a sports economist. You're not a rock and roll economist. But does that sound like an idea that works?
Well, not if they're serious about that. Doesn't sound like it works. But, look, it's going to depend, again, at the end of the day, on how much private money is being spent and how much public money is being spent, and not only upfront overt money, but indirect subsidies and tax benefits that are going to go to private investors. Most arenas around the United States can operate on a profitable basis if they have 250 events or more during the course of the year. Real events. I'm not talking about, inviting two high school teams to come play once or twice a year, but real commercial events, 250 plus a year. If you have an NBA team there, then you've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to 50 events, depending on preseason and postseason games. If you have a hockey team, it's the same thing, 45 to 50. If you have both of those, you're talking about 90 to 100 events a year out of 250. So that takes you a long way towards hitting that figure of 250. If you don't have the hockey or basketball teams, it's pretty hard to get to that number. The notion of having 40 Pearl Jam concerts or 40 Bruce Springsteen concerts or Paul McCartney concerts or whoever it's going to be hasn't added up. I mean, you can have a handful of those concerts from each of the top 5 or 10 performers in the country, perhaps, and maybe that takes you to 30, 40, or 50 out of the 250 number. But if you're going to run it like a nightclub and think that you can have concerts every night of the year there in an arena that holds 18,000 or 20,000 capacity seats, then it strikes me as unrealistic.
Pearl Jam, we're going to need you to play more. Every night. You're going to become commuters to Seattle Center, Pearl Jam. So, Professor, Seattle has disappointed the NBA before, and the Sonics left. We, as you said, are secure enough of a city to not be desperate for NBA basketball or NHL hockey. So why does the NBA want, apparently, so badly to come back to Seattle?
Well, look, I mean, the reason why the Supersonics had problems in Seattle primarily had to do with the fact that you had an older arena. I think it's a perfectly good arena, but it's not an arena that generates the kind of revenue that you get in the new arenas, because you don't have the same extent of luxury suites and club seating and restaurants and catering and signage opportunities that they do in the new arenas. Seattle itself is a great city. Seattle is the 13th or 14th largest media market in the country. It's a high-income area of the country. It's an area of the country that supports professional sports. And when you're looking at alternatives like going to, I don't know, Austin or Las Vegas, which are the 39th and 40th largest media markets in the country, Seattle is much better. It's a preferable market. They also like to geographically cover as much of the country as possible. You know, and unlike Las Vegas, Seattle not only has its what's called a designated media market, which is basically Seattle and the suburbs, but as you push out and you go 30 and 40 and 50 miles away from Seattle, you still have active and significant population groups. But if you go 50 miles away from Las Vegas, you're in the desert. So the NBA would like to be in Seattle. David Stern told me way back just before the Supersonics left that they'd like to be in Seattle. They just want to have and need to have a more modern arena to perpetuate and grow their business model.
When do you think it's going to happen, Professor? When does Seattle have NBA basketball again?
Well, that's up to the people in Seattle and the politicians in Seattle to decide. It's not up to me. But I do think that it's likely within the next 5 years that the NBA will be back.
Next 5 years?
Yeah.
We've waited that long. Andrew Zimbalist, sports economist, professor at Smith College. Thank you for this.
Good to talk to you.
Andrew Zimbalist saying Seattle's more secure than cities like Las Vegas and will drive a harder bargain with the NBA than those insecure cities will. But he's challenging the idea that Seattle's going to minimize public financing of a sports stadium. Not convinced it's going to be all that minimal and says you need to wait for the details. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today, the 18th of April, and the mountain is not out today. The mountain's not out. That doesn't mean anything to you if you've just moved here. When locals say the mountain, we mean Rainier to the south-southeast of Seattle. It's often invisible, including today. It's not out. It's showing. Well, you see a little foothill. It's showing its ankles. That's about it. Now, the mountain being out, that's a very simple geological observation. If you really want to impress friends when they visit you here, you're going to need to drop some deeper geo knowledge on them. And our next guest can help you with that. Geology professor Nick Zentner, Central Washington University, has made it his life's mission to teach people how our Northwest landscape got so impressive. So, Professor, what is one cool feature that a local can point to and say to a friend, hey, see that over there? Here's the story.
There is something you can point to, Bill. If you take the ferry out to Bainbridge Island from downtown Seattle and you look to the south, you've got both Alki Point and Restoration Point on Bainbridge Island. And there's this really interesting little shelf. It's a bunch of flat real estate that's right there by the water, but that's a flat shelf that used to be in the water and literally popped out of the water during a big earthquake.
It popped and, out?
Yeah, it was discovered kind of in the mid-1960s and then kind of refined in the early 90s when I was moving to the Northwest. And so it's all related to the Seattle Fault. So the idea is that everything south of that east-west trending crack lifted by about 21 feet at the snap of a finger. And so that bedrock, which should be underwater, was lifted out of the water suddenly, and that platform, those series of platforms, is the great evidence we have, among other things, for this really impressive fault that's also kind of scary.
Yeah. When did this quake happen?
Well, the best date is about the year 900 AD, so more than 1,000 years ago. And the big question, of course, is if that's the last earthquake on this fault, will it happen again? And the answer is yes, but like with many things, we cannot predict exactly when it's going to happen.
Popping 21 feet in the air, what would that be on the Richter scale, do you figure?
Yeah, not only the popping of the land, but some other kinds of deposits were used to try to estimate the magnitude, since we're talking so long ago. We're probably magnitude 7.1, possibly as much as 7.4. And so, yeah, we're not talking about a little minor Tumblr that Grandma's China is going to get rattled a little bit. It's probably more than that.
Well, I was mentioning newcomers earlier. Maybe we should have known about that before we moved here, because it tells me what danger we're in.
Well, as I'm kind of fond of saying, you know, there's lots of wonderful geology that's safely tucked in the past, but all of our natural beauty, of course, is a direct result of these things that are still active, and so that's part of the gimmick, I'm afraid. That's part of the brochure. If you come up here and you see this wonderful stuff, that means there's some danger ahead.
Yeah, beautiful because we're volatile. What is something that we're doing that you think is stupid given our geology?
Well, stupid, huh? Well, you know, there's the obvious answer, where you build your dream home in a floodplain, and then there's a tremendous flood, and then you feel like it's just bad luck. I mean, that's just not tuning into how natural systems work. But the opposite of stupid, I guess, is trying to learn about all this wonderful research that's been going on, and trying to be updated as current as you can on what we know and what we don't know about earthquake and volcanic risk. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with a couple of these projects we've been working on.
Yeah, I can tell that's really important for you, that you want people to learn about the geology of this place. Why is that? What do you want us to learn and why?
There is interest. People love a particular place, or they have memories of their kids at that particular ridge or something like that. And so if you can make a connection between this interesting science and this kind of intimate family connection stuff, then this becomes not just a passing interest among people, but it is a fervent thing. I've been surprised at the level of interest with many folks with the geology. So I'm just trying to tap into that interest.
Is every part of America equally fascinating if you're interested, or are you prepared to admit now, Professor, that the Pacific Northwest is geologically superior?
Hey, man, I'm happy to admit that. Yeah, you know, I regularly say, you know, this is not Iowa, this is not Nebraska. And first, my first teaching job was in Ohio, Miami of Ohio, in the Cincinnati area. And, you know, there's limestone and cornfields, and that's about it, I'm afraid. So I purposely came out here, and so I'm happy to preach, as a matter of fact, that this is just Disneyland for geologists.
Why have you come to care so much about Washington State geology? Why is this the thing you're spending your life doing?
Well, I think the best answer is I have learned all of this wonderful work that's been done by generations of field geologists. You know, these are tremendous levels of dedication and accuracy and detail. And it ends up on a shelf, you know, or it's a very closed community with just geologists talking to other geologists. And so early on, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now, so this is 30 years ago. Early on, I just realized that all this stuff wasn't getting out there. I mean, it just wasn't being communicated, and it felt like a shame because there's great work. It's not only helping to mitigate hazards in the future, but it's just enjoying a place much more if you have a little perspective. So I kind of tapped into that, and that was before the internet, so you would just give a public lecture. And then, of course, now with video and social media and the internet in general, boy, you can spread the word much easier and much more visually than you could before.
Finally, I mentioned newcomers at the top of this, Professor.
Yeah.
But really, I guess for newbies and long-timers as well, how do you wish that we would walk through life here in Washington?
Well, there's so many things to be interested in, of course, Bill. You know, it's not just the geology, so it seems silly for me to just say everybody should drop all their interest and just pay attention to all this wonderful geology. But I think it's, in a broad sense, it's just being in tune with the natural world. And of course, many of our residents do make it a point to get away from I-5 and get up into the hills a little bit, and there's so much to be gained from that. And so our work with KCTS and Central Washington University, that collaboration has allowed us to get this little PBS program going, and it's just trying to showcase that. And I'm hoping that people, if they're not aware of all these wonderful places and concepts, will kind of take a weekend and go out and see a few of these places.
That PBS series is called Nick on the Rocks. You can see it on KCTS 9 here in Seattle. Nick Zentner, Professor of Geology at Central Washington University. Thanks so much for the time, Professor.
Thank you, Bill.
Again, Nick on the Rocks airs on KCTS Sundays at 6:30, or you can watch them online right now because we are tweeting out a link at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, keeping you up on the news today. I'm sure you know about the murder that was recorded and posted to Facebook, and police had been searching for the killer. Well, now their suspect is dead. He shot himself in Pennsylvania after a two-day manhunt, and we'll bring you all the details this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Starts at 3 o'clock. This weekend, scientists and their supporters plan to march for science.
Why? Well, I'm a scientist. I care deeply about science, and I'm worried at the moment about societal support for science, even at the level of acknowledging that policy should be based on facts.
That's University of Washington Professor Dave Montgomery. He plans to march here in Seattle, which is one of hundreds of cities around the country where the marches for science are going to happen, including Washington, D.C. But not all scientists believe that a march is the right kind of activism. KUOW's David Hyde reports from the banks of South Lake Union.
Nicole Baker is a research scientist at the University of Washington. She studies the state of global fish stocks.
So their B over BMSY or F over MSY are closer to one. Those are healthy stocks, so we're going to look at if...
It's definitely not political work. Baker's 30 years old. She's never been an activist. She's never even participated in a political march before.
I did not have any level of political engagement when I was in college. I studied and had fun and traveled, and politics was not even on my radar.
But last year, when Donald Trump ran for president, Baker got political for the first time in her life.
I think the nomination of Scott Pruitt as the EPA chief who doesn't believe in climate change just totally put me over the edge.
She's alarmed that President Trump and some members of his cabinet seem to dismiss basic science, and that President Trump slashed science research funding in his proposed budget. But Baker does not see the March for Science as about one political party or the other.
I just think that it's not a partisan issue. I think if there was a Democratic president who was doing the same things, I would feel the same way about marching.
Robert Young agrees with Baker that science is under attack, but he thinks marching is the wrong tactic.
That's going to reinforce the messages that they've been getting from the conservative media all along. That the scientists are really just liberal environmentalists, or the scientists have their own political agenda.
Robert Young is a coastal geologist at Western Carolina University, and he's spent more than a decade studying the Elwha Dam removal project here in Washington State. And he thinks the Science March reveals a larger problem with how scientists sometimes talk about their work to the general public, that they're not always thinking hard enough about how their messages will be received by people who don't know any scientists or people who live in places where Donald Trump won.
You know, I can't go to talk to my in-laws about climate change and start the conversation with polar bears. My in-laws live in eastern North Carolina. What they care about is having a job and, you know, what the soybean crop is this year. They don't care about polar bears, and you may think that that's terrible, but that's the way that the world works.
Sarah Myrie has a very different perspective on the march.
To say that science is not political and to say that we're going to have problems down the line if we politicize science, it's like saying, you know, science is about empiricism, which is this pure thing up above our heads that doesn't have anything to do with politics. And frankly, that's wrong.
Sarah Myrie is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington and one of the march organizers here in Seattle. And for Myrie, it's not just a march for science. It's also a march against how science is currently organized. She says it excludes women and minorities.
We are marching to defend an inclusive and diverse culture inside of science, a culture that accepts women as a part of the scientific community, a culture that accepts people of color and people that have been disenfranchised inside of science. And so there are incredibly important social and cultural issues that interface with the scientific community right now, and those are also a part of the March for Science.
So not every scientist is going to be marching for the same reason, and not every scientist is going to march. But everyone I spoke with had one thing in common, a shared belief that something important about the identity of the country is at stake if people don't stand up for science right now.
Think about the things that American science has done in the last 100 years. We put people on the moon. We landed an instrument on an asteroid. We have a robot driving around Mars right now. We are a driving force across the entire planet for health and safety and reducing costs and reducing risk.
In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
And you'll hear more this week about how scientists are responding to President Trump's election as KUOW's politics team covers activism during Trump's first 100 days. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State grows 70% of the apples in the United States, and most of those apples are Red Delicious. But Americans don't really buy Red Delicious apples anymore. Only half of the 2016 crop has been sold, and the majority of those have gone overseas. Most American shoppers like other varieties. The Honeycrisp, the Gala, the Pink Lady. So apple growers are changing things up. They're planting a new variety, the Cosmic Crisp apple, a breed that has developed at Washington State University. NPR's food reporter Dan Charles has been out in the orchards of Wenatchee reporting on the first Cosmic Crisp trees going into the ground. Charles told Jeannie Yandel that growers are making a pretty big bet on Cosmic Crisp.
They're spending a lot of money to tear out old trees, put in new trees. The trees are expensive. The trellises are expensive. It's, you know, like $50,000 an acre to plant these things. And nobody in a supermarket has actually ever picked up a Cosmic Crisp apple. So nobody, here, I got a little prop. Nobody has actually walked into a supermarket and seen this exact apple. I'm holding in my hands a Cosmic Crisp that
wow.
I got through secret, you know, channels. But this is the apple. Nobody knows if anybody actually likes it yet.
How are the growers themselves feeling about taking that risk?
Well, you know, there's risks of not doing it, too. There are a lot of apple growers in Washington State who are growing Red Delicious apples, often shipping them overseas because Americans aren't really buying them much anymore. They're getting lousy prices. So, you know, they have a sort of a money-losing deal at the moment. So a lot of them have been looking for a new, you know, a new variety to sort of to grab a hold of, you know, a train to jump on, which will take them to prosperity. And some of them have not managed to kind of get into the clubs that grow some of the, you know, spiffy new varieties that you see in the grocery store. This one, everybody can plant. People say it's a great apple. They're hoping it's going to be really popular. This is the new wave that they can ride.
Dan Charles, you're holding this apple. You're gesturing with it. What does it look like? What does the Cosmic Crisp apple look like?
Well, take a look at it. Okay. So it's pretty red. I mean, one side of it is actually quite dark red. It looks like a kind of a Red Delicious.
I honestly thought you were pulling a Red Delicious apple out of your pocket when you first did that.
But it's rounder. It's got these kind of yellow speckles on it, which they kind of, that's where the cosmic comes from.
They're apparently supposed to look like stars, right?
It's supposed to look like sort of bright shining stars in a dark red night sky. The one parent of this apple is a Honeycrisp, which we all, well, many people know and love and pay lots of money for. The other parent is less well known. It's called Enterprise. The great characteristics of this apple, you know, you bite into and it's got that sort of crack, you know, that crispness from Honeycrisp. It's a little more tart than, say, a Honeycrisp or a Fuji, but it's also got a lot of sugar too. So it's supposed to, you know, really be a winner when it comes to what people taste when they bite into it. But it's also a lot easier to grow than, say, Honeycrisp. So the growers are pretty excited because this apple promises to be one that they will get, you know, lots of boxes out of the orchard compared to Honeycrisp, which has been difficult for many of them.
You said that supposedly the Cosmic Crisp apple has this great flavor. Have you tried this apple yet?
I have tried it.
Do you like it?
I do like it, yeah. But everybody's different, right? So everybody is going to have a different reaction to this taste. And will it be the super winner that people are willing to pay a dollar extra for or even $2 extra for the way they do with Honeycrisp? That's the big hope, you know, because considering the money that people are putting into like growing this variety, it's got to be a premium apple. They can't sell this for gala prices and make money. This has got to be up closer to Honeycrisp for it to be worth the bet, really.
Wow. So even if someone was willing to pay gala prices for this new apple, that still doesn't mean that this risk pays off for all these growers in Washington State.
No, gala prices are not enough. I mean, gala prices are more kind of run-of-the-mill prices. That's like the second biggest variety grown in Washington State, still behind Red Delicious, which is still number one after all these years. This one, though, is taking off so fast. This is like the fastest launch in history of any apple variety ever.
Why?
Well, because of these two factors. It seems like a great apple, and this is the one that anybody can order. Anybody can sort of get in on this train, and people have been looking for something new to plant. So this spring, there's only limited quantities available, fewer than a million trees, but every tree that growers can get their hands on is going into the ground. Next spring, you know, there's this huge scale up because the nurseries now have more what they call budwood available to graft onto rootstock to make new trees to put in the ground. Next spring, 5 million trees, 5 million Cosmic Crisp trees are going to go into the ground. Millions more the following year. It's really like overnight, this is going to be a pretty major new variety. Never happened before.
And all of those trees are going in the ground here in Washington State, right?
They can only go into the ground here in Washington State. So this variety was developed by researchers at Washington State University, which means two things. One is they do kind of have an obligation to make it available to any grower who wants to grow it here in Washington State. It is a public institution, after all. They are paying royalties. You know, they're treating it like sort of a, you know, they're treating it like intellectual property, which it is. Washington State University is getting royalties from this thing. But they are letting any grower in Washington State grow it. But they're saying only growers in Washington State are allowed to grow it. So that's another reason why it's so popular here. They feel like, okay, this is our apple. You know, other growers, other apple, you know, other orchardists in Michigan and New York State and whatnot, they can't get their hands on it yet.
I'm talking with NPR food reporter Dan Charles about the Cosmic Crisp apple. And if you haven't bought one of those apples yet, that's because they're not available in grocery stores yet. This is a new variety of apple developed here in Washington State for the near future anyway. Only growers in Washington State are going to be able to grow Cosmic Crisp apples. And I want to unpack some of what you've said about just the industry of growing apples in the United States. How did we get to a point where some varieties are overwhelmingly popular? We see all of these different varieties in the store, but growers have to figure out what's worth growing and what's not worth growing. How did we get here?
Well, years ago, there was basically one apple. There was the American apple. It was the red delicious apple, the one you saw, you know, iconically in, you know, magazines and whatnot. You still see it in the stores. And then a combination of things happened. New varieties came on the market that were just better, right? And they were different. And the thing that really changed the industry was Honeycrisp. There was no big marketing campaign behind Honeycrisp. It came out of the University of Minnesota. But just the word of mouth, you know, carried that thing to enormous popularity. It was hard to grow. Supplies were limited for quite a while. But people were paying, for the apple industry, extraordinary prices for this thing. So it kind of woke up the whole industry to the idea that consumers would actually pay extra for a particular variety that they wanted. And that just sort of unleashed this whole sort of wave of like marketing and sort of intellectual property control to sort of capture the benefits of these new varieties and also plant breeding and introducing new varieties into the marketplace that they hoped would, you know, like be the next Honeycrisp. There has not yet been a next Honeycrisp. The Washington State industry hopes that this is.
Can I try the apple?
No. This is the only apple. This is the only apple, the only Cosmic Crisp apple I have, and I want to take it home with me to show my wife.
Fair enough. I'll just assume. It looks delicious, so I'll just assume that it also tastes delicious. Thank you so much, Dan Charles.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Charles is NPR's food reporter, and he told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel about the Cosmic Crisp apple, a new variety developed at Washington State University. It'll show up in stores in the fall of 2019. And you know, last year we talked with one of the WSU researchers who developed the Cosmic Crisp, Kate Evans, and we're tweeting out a link to that interview right now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Coming up this afternoon, Tour de Roche just went through a big change. A few months ago, he had a sex reassignment surgery. He's about to start taking testosterone. And to find out what to expect, he sat down with a transgender man who physically transitioned from female to male 8 years ago, and they let us record their conversation. It's one of the stories you'll hear today on KUOW's All Things Considered. It starts at 3 o'clock. So glad you tuned in today and gave us a listen.